Hello.
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 Hello, my name is Matthew West, and I'm the host of this podcast. It's called the Matthew West Podcast. I really hope you like it.
Hello.
Here we go. It's going to be a good one today, guys. Welcome to another episode of the Matthew West Podcast. I'm your host, Matthew West. And as always, I really hope you like it. Here's another thing I hope. I hope you had a great Easter. Easter for the West family was a little bit different. We had to be apart from each other this time because I had the opportunity to lead worship and perform some special music for an amazing church in Texas. So thanks to everyone in Texas who came out to worship with us. Wherever you were worshiping, I hope that you were joining me in lifting your voices and celebrating this fact that our God is alive. He is risen. Amen. I tell you what, I want to share a little Easter story before we get into today's show, and it's called Love the Easter Bunny. Now, I told this story in my book, Hello, My Name Is, and it's really less of a story about Easter and more of a story about a parent fail, and that is my fail. Lulu was losing her baby teeth quite rapidly, actually, and we were having a hard time keeping up with the loss of her teeth. You know, we were trying to make sure that the illusion of the tooth fairy was still alive and well. Don't ask me why. And so we would, you know, sneak in after she went to bed and we'd take the tooth from under her pillow and leave a little cash. Well, it was happening at such a rapid pace that I was starting to kind of, you know, get a little worn out. And so one night my wife told me I was in charge of being the tooth fairy. And I said, oh, yeah, I got it. And then I totally forgot. We woke up the next morning and my wife woke me up. She said, did you forget? And I started to panic and I thought, oh, this is it. This is the end of her innocence. She's going to grow up here right in this moment and realize that the tooth fairy isn't real. But instead of settling for that parent fail, I decided to go even farther in my fail because I had what I thought was a genius idea. So I wrote a letter and I wrote it with my opposite hand. And it was supposed to be a letter that would inform my daughter that the tooth fairy decided it would be more fun, this tooth, to hide the money and have a little scavenger hunt. And so I wrote this letter and I was like, dear Lulu, congratulations on losing another tooth. I have hidden your prize somewhere in the house. And here are some clues. Good luck. And then I signed it, Love the Easter Bunny. Lulu reads the letter out loud, and then she gets to the end and she says, Love the Easter Bunny. Like there's a question mark at the end. Love the Easter Bunny. Daddy, I don't understand. Why would the Easter Bunny write me a letter? Why not the Tooth Fairy? And I looked at my wife, and my wife looked at me, and she shot me the look that let me know I was about to be in the doghouse for about a 30-day sentence if I didn't think of something quick. And so I stepped in. I said, oh, you know what, honey? The Tooth Fairy has been so busy lately that sometimes the Easter Bunny steps in to help out. So how cool is that, that the Easter Bunny decided to help the Tooth Fairy with you? Then I held my breath and waited to see if she'd take the bait. She looked at the letter, looked at the Easter Bunny's signature, looked back at me, looked back at the letter, and then she looked up and said to my wife and I, that is cool, Dad. That Easter Bunny, he's amazing. That was a close one, my friends. And I avoided the doghouse. Man, everything went smoothly. But here's the moral of that story, all right? We celebrate all these silly fairy tales over the holidays, but aren't you thankful that this holiday of Easter that we just celebrated together, we're not celebrating a fairy tale. We are celebrating a fact. We're not celebrating some made-up thing. We're celebrating this truth that our God, he is not a fairy tale. Our God is real. He's alive, he is risen, and he's in control of our crazy lives. Can I get an amen, people? All right, let's get into today's show. My guest today is co-host of one of the most popular shows on cable television, Fox News The Five. She's co-anchor of America's Newsroom and an analyst for Fox News election coverage and specials. She's a number one New York Times best-selling author. She was the first ever Republican woman to hold the job of White House press secretary for President George W. Bush. She served over 7 years in that administration, including at the Department of Justice after the terrorist attacks on 9/11. She lives in Manhattan. She's an amazing individual, and she's just released a great new book that we're going to get to talk about today. Let's go to the Story House with Dana Perino. I'm super excited to be talking with you. Thanks for joining me today.
Thank you.
So you've just released this book, Everything Will Be Okay. It sounds like it could be a book. It's a title that feels like a message you could be sending to our entire nation right now. And yet you've chosen to focus its message towards young women and really helping them to achieve their greatest capacity, telling them that they can, right? And helping them to reach greater heights. So I was just thinking what's the first question I want to ask Dana? And first of all, I'm like, okay, Dana is in the business of interviewing people and I better do a good job. So, but the first thought I had was, I want to know, like, who told you that you could in your life? Like, did you have voices around you that were making you believe that all the things that you were going to accomplish were actually possible? Who was it? Who are those voices in your life that helped you believe that that was possible?
I have to say the first one, but by the way, I know you have children. Do you have daughters?
I have two daughters. Yeah. And that's why I'm super excited about your desire to be a mentor and to speak into young women's lives. So this book is going to be in their hands soon.
Okay. So the reason I say that is that when you're asking me that, I have to say it's my dad initially, right? So he grew up on a ranch in Wyoming. Not to say that my mom wasn't also encouraging, but when you ask me that question, and I say, who's the first? So my dad grew up on a ranch, the first of three boys. There hadn't been a girl born in our family in a long, long time till I came along. I was the first grandchild. So I was born in 1972. And so the feminist movement is really just getting underway, right? And that early feminist marketing was so pitiful. But I remember my dad bought a t-shirt for me. It was yellow, short sleeve, in big black letters that said, anything boys can do, girls can do better. But I remember hearing from him also, like, you can be anything. You can always do it. And when I was in the third grade, my dad started a tradition with me where I had to read the Rocky Mountain News and the Denver Post every day before he got home from work. And I had to choose two articles to discuss before dinner. It could be anything I wanted. And then we would, you know, before dinner, we would go through them. And, you know, I think back and I think my dad was trying to help me with one. He wanted me to have an interest in current events, but to learn about government and improve my critical thinking skills. And actually, I think like back then, it helped me in the future, because I remember being on Marine One with President Bush, obviously decades later, and I was explaining something to the president from my point of view. And I had this image of flashback to the kitchen table of being able to express yourself confidently in front of a dominant male figure. And of course, my dad didn't know I was going to end up as a White House press secretary, but that early push was really, really important. There's a saying in mentoring circles that you have to see her to be her. And again, like, women have made a ton of strides in the last 40 years or so, but a long way to go. At the time, I wanted to be in news. And at the top of the profession, at the network news, the only three people who had ever held those jobs were, in my mind's eye, right? It was Peter Jennings, Tom Brokaw, and Dan Rather. And so I wanted to do local news. That was my thought. But this is before cable news was even really invented. So that early intervention, I think, was super important that helped me. I would say also that when I look back, one of the reasons I call it Everything Will Be Okay is that young women today, they very much want you to give them a plan that they promise to follow. It's like if they ask me, how can I become White House press secretary?
Right.
I will say, well, the first thing you have to do is become a country music DJ working overnights for minimum wage. And if you do that, then you will. It's actually one of the reasons I love the stories about songwriters and their success, because there's always some, there's like one thing that happens, and it could be a chance encounter, or it just so happened that Rascal Flatts heard your song, like, hey, let's cut this.
And no two maps have the same point A to point B. There, I mean, like, you just, I love that image of
and
you.
And that's the joy of life too. But right now, one of the reasons I wrote the book is because young women, wildly ambitious, talented, educated, but so stressed out, so worried, so much pressure that they're piling on themselves. And they think that they have to know exactly what's going to happen next before they make a move. And my point to them is that everything will be okay. That doesn't mean that you don't have to work at it or be prepared or set yourself apart from a competitive standpoint.
It's not coddling. It's not.
No, not at all. Or like being passive.
Right.
Basically, like if you're watching 8 hours of Bravo a day, like it's not going to be okay.
Right. That should have been your subtitle.
Yeah, maybe better.
Shots fired against Bravo. No, I totally get what you're saying. But even the title, Everything Will Be Okay, is kind of, that's a grouping of words that I would consider, like from a songwriter standpoint, it's like that's an exhale collection of words. Like, everything will be okay. And it sounds like what you're getting at with the theme of this book and chapter by chapter is, hey, you're going to have your own point A to point B. Your map's going to look different. Your story's going to read different than everybody else's. But here are some helpful lessons along the way to help you on your unique God-given journey. And you talked about the word mentor. So I, first of all, I got to just say, I love that Dad got a shout out right away. I love the fact that early in your life, the image of that yellow t-shirt still sticks out and how that sticks with you to where you're talking with the president and feeling confident to be able to deliver that. I'm going to guess that you had some voices that were not so positive and not so encouraging and negative. Like you said, you didn't really have an example of what you wanted to become. What did you say? You have to see her to be her?
To be her. Yeah.
And did you have some critical voices in your life as well that were trying to make you believe the ceiling was lower for you than it actually was?
Well, I think that all of us have this, and it's that negative self-talk. The person that is the most critical of you is actually yourself.
Yeah, no, that's the truth in my life.
Yeah, I think that is actually, it's the battle of good versus evil, right? And we are so much in our own heads. I think social media has exacerbated things. Because I have a line in the book, I'm quoting Roosevelt, that comparison is the thief of joy.
I literally just put that quote in a song last year in the music world. And I'm going to guess it's the same way in most professions. I mean, you talk about stealing your joy when you're focusing on social media, on everybody else's accomplishments. I love that quote.
One thing that was quite an adversity in my life was, so I grew up in Denver, Colorado. And in the, it must have been like 1982 or so, 81, Denver was the first city to attempt to integrate the schools through busing.
Okay.
So whereas I had walked to school three blocks away from kindergarten through third grade, starting in the fourth grade, I had to be bused 20 miles across the city to a different school. And the children living near that school were bused over to my neighborhood, to that school. And that was a terrible experiment for everybody involved. I remember I would pray on my way to school, even afterwards, constantly all day long, just rotely pray, please don't let them be mad at me tomorrow. And just constantly over and over again. And it was not something even you wanted to tell your parents because you don't want to be a tattletale. Anyway, my parents pick up that it's not going well. Ultimately, we moved out to the countryside and I went to a school that was very rural. But you know, the thing that really helped me is I joined the speech team, the speech and debate team. So I played sports and stuff, but I realized I'm like, I'm not going to be a pro athlete and I'm not getting a scholarship. I'm 5 feet tall. Like, it's not happening. And even though I was in gymnastics, I'm like, I couldn't do a backflip with no hands. So that's obviously not happening. So I joined the speech team, and if I look back to like the one thing that made a big difference in my life, I would say it was that. And I encourage young women, if you have issues with confidence, the speech team is kind of considered not the cool kids, but that's where you make all your friends.
What made that the place where you picked up real friends and gained confidence?
I feel like, you know, if I look back, gosh, this is almost like therapy, and I love it.
I'll be billing you.
Thank you. I think that it was kind of one of the first places I felt I could be myself, that it was okay to be smart.
Interesting.
I was student council president. I got straight A's. But still, there's always that pull of you want to be popular. You want to be liked with the professions that I've chosen. Sometimes, like, that's wanting not to be the liked. Pretty tough. But all of us do. Like, even like the president I worked for, George W. Bush, would he like to be liked? Yes. But what was more important? that he could look himself in the eye and know that his integrity was intact. I start the book off with a story about preserving your integrity and how that is your most valuable asset. This young woman came to me and she didn't want to say what they were asking her to say. So I said, well, then don't say it. She said, I don't think I can do that. I don't think I can refuse because I'm not Dana Perino. And I said, how do you think I became Dana Perino?
Wow.
And she's like, oh, I'm like, right.
So you had moments in your career early on where you had to decide integrity over popularity, even as you were, and you probably were faced with the reality of, I mean, were there any moments where you were like, man, I might lose my job for standing up for what I think is right here?
Not at the White House, although I write up, there is a story in which I say that I did something where I thought I was going to get fired. Like, well, let's go back. So I'm a firstborn daughter. So those are usually perfectionists. And I had a chart on the refrigerator with stars.
Yes.
You know, I could earn a star for chores or grades. Nothing I wouldn't do to get another star.
Wow.
And that's still true to this day. My co-anchor, Bill Hemmer, will say, oh, are you trying to get another star on your chart? Because I'm trying to be like nice to the producers.
Just overachiever. Yeah.
Yeah. And I think that that obviously became quite difficult for me to deal with in a way, because there's disappointments along the way, right? And there's at one point I write about in the book about one time I got kicked out of the Oval Office.
Okay, you have to tell me why.
This is a great story to me. Well, I write in the book about how to get over disappointments. So I'd been on the job as deputy press secretary for 3 days. I'd been in the administration before that, but not in the Oval Office. So I've been there like 3 days, and I don't even know if the president knew my name, to be honest.
Okay.
And the communications director asked me to join him in the Oval Office to brief the president for an interview he was going to do at 11 a.m., but the communications director couldn't stick around for the interview, and could I handle that part?
Oh, wow. Okay.
Okay, so this is my first time being in the Oval Office with him, and Dan said, don't worry, I'll do the brief. You just have to do the sit through the interview and cut it off, you know, like a PR person
right,
does.
Right.
Okay. So I go to the Oval Office. I'm so nervous. I'm standing there as Dan's doing the brief, and the president said, wait, I'm not doing an interview with that guy.
What?
And Dan said, no, remember you said you would talk to him today? And the president says, I said I would talk to him. I did not say I would do an interview with him.
Oh, okay.
So there's a miscommunication.
Yeah, yeah.
And you can imagine who won.
I'm going to guess.
And so the president says, and therefore, she doesn't need to be here. And then he looked at me and went like this, like, see yourself out.
Oh, wow. Wow. Okay.
I melted completely. I slithered back to my desk. It was like 32 steps.
Yeah.
I closed the door behind me. It was like a sliding door. And I called my husband and I was very tearful. And I told him what happened. And he said, well, just think, for the rest of your life, you can say, I've been kicked out of better places than this.
That's incredible. Oh, what a great story.
So 6 years later, after the White House, I'm doing the PR for the president's book tour. And I said, Mr. President, do you remember when you kicked me out of the Oval Office?
He had
no
recollection.
I never kicked you out of the Oval Office. He said, no, don't you remember? And then Dan said this, and then you said you weren't going to do the interview, and I was wearing this thing, and I had my shoes on. And don't you remember? I remember every detail. And he was like, I have no recollection of this. And he said, are you still upset? And I was like, a little bit. Oh. And he said, I think you could let that one go. And the thing is, I think that all people do this, but I tend to think young women do it a little bit more. Like if you make a mistake at the office, one of the things that I talk about in this book is, how do you bounce back from a setback? Or if you take a punch, can you get up?
That's good. Yeah.
Because if you are constantly second guessing yourself, you can't just move on. I've learned something in live TV that was very helpful. Let's say you're reading the teleprompter and you say somebody's name wrong or mispronounce something or get something wrong. I learned from people here, it's like, it's live TV. You get to do it again tomorrow.
Yeah, yeah. So shake it off quickly.
That's great. Like, shake it off, yeah.
And so many, I mean, to steal from Taylor Swift, but so many are dealing right now with some sort of a disappointment or a dream deferred, a lost job, the lack of anything positive in their lives right now. So is that really one of your big takeaways from the disappointments that you've had, where it's just like, how quickly can you bounce back from that?
And also, can you show your boss, got it, learn from that, promise you that'll never happen again, and then move on? Because your boss doesn't want you to dwell on it, and they don't have time for you to dwell on it, right? You have to be able to show that you can move on. And that could mean that you have to call your boyfriend or your husband or listen to Taylor Swift, Shake It Off 100 times just so you can move on. But, you know, she's a great example of somebody who, as I understand it, has done quite a bit. I don't know, mentoring per se, but Dierks Bentley was telling me one time that he took his girls to see one of her concerts and how they got to see her backstage and what it meant to him as a girl dad to have somebody like Taylor Swift take a moment.
Oh, man.
To show the girls, like, you can do this. You'll be okay. And that's one of the reasons I also wrote the book. It's not like I have a lot of spare time on my hands. Nobody does. But I wanted to put all of it in one place so that there's a resource. Because there really hasn't been there's not a modern guide. And when my mom read the book, she said, there was nothing like this when I was starting.
Well, that's the amazing thing is what Taylor did for Dierks' kids in that moment, you're doing for so many young women through this book who maybe go, you know, I don't have a mentor in my life of that actual person. Or think about, you know, for every story of a girl growing up whose dad gets her a yellow shirt that says anything boys can do, girls can do better, there's a girl growing up with the exact opposite upbringing. And that's really the why for a book like this, is for those women out there who go, you know what? I haven't had the positive role model speaking into my life. And so I think about how many women, and you know what? We have men and women listening to this podcast, men included, who they're going to grow up and they're going to say, you know what? My dad never told me I would amount to anything. I mean, some of the stories that I read, Dana, from people all around the world, I collect people's stories and those stories inspire my songs. And it's unbelievable to me how many people grow up with these busted, broken chapters, even from their childhood, where they were told what they're not capable of more than what they are capable of. And so there's a huge why for this book.
I had a lot of educational inferiority complexes. And what I mean by that is I went to the University of Southern Colorado, great school, but not like great school, but good school.
Right.
I was on a speech team scholarship, but then I go to work at the White House and I'm surrounded by everybody at the White House went to the Ivy Leagues.
Okay. So they had this like pedigree, if you will, that you maybe didn't feel like you measured up to.
People would ask me where I went and I would say USC and they'd be like, oh, that's awesome. Like, yeah. The Indians, not the Trojans.
That's funny.
And it took me a while to realize, like, oh, wait, it doesn't matter. He turns to me for advice as much as he turns to them.
Wow.
And I know I grew up in that world where I was public school, regular college situation. I do not want any young woman across this country or man to have education inferiority complexes because it does not matter.
And before we move on from the White House, because you said he and the president, but what did that mean for him to go from being kicked out of the Oval Office, you know, in those early days where you were wondering, am I going to be here long enough even for a cup of coffee, to have the endorsement of the president where you become the White House press secretary? What did that type of, was that another like yellow t-shirt moment for you of somebody believing in you?
One of my pieces of advice is always take the deputy job. Because in the deputy role or the vice manager or the vice president, in that role, you have to work holidays and weekends, but that's when you get to know the boss.
That's good. Yeah.
You know, you can make a mistake along the way, but he would get to know us personally. I remember sharing peanut butter and honey sandwiches with him on Marine One, coming back from the Boy Scouts Jamboree, and him just asking about me and my family. So you fast forward, and last week, I was in Dallas at the Bush Center, and he came to my book event.
You're kidding.
Yeah, he came, and he also gave me a painting that he had just done. He's painting like 2.5 hours a day, and it's my most treasured possession.
And they're amazing.
He's very good. But the thing that I was asked on stage, and he's there in the audience with Mrs. Bush, I was asked, you know, what was the best advice you ever got from President Bush? So I said, well, there's actually two. There's a career one, and then there's a personal one or a personal moment. And the career one was when I left the White House and he encouraged me to start my own business. And I had 13 reasons why I shouldn't start my own business. I would never be successful. And he said, yeah, I'm not persuaded by that. And he made me ask myself this question. What's the worst thing that could happen?
Oh, that's good.
And so we walked through that and he said, so you're telling me the worst thing that could happen is your business doesn't succeed and you have to work for a PR firm. Like, you know, and I do believe what something he used to say, and I say this also in the book, if you're born in America, you've already won life's great lottery because you're free.
Yeah. Yeah.
And if you're an educated person and you have the love of your family, nothing can hold you back except for you.
Yeah. Yeah. That's great.
So then the personal side was that he really got to know me. I talked about my dad, and we hadn't seen each other a lot, well, at all, really, during the White House years. And President Bush knew about this. And there was a dinner coming up with Prime Minister Berlusconi. He was the Italian prime minister. And because my last name is Perino, I got on the invite list. And there were 100 people coming. And my husband is British, but became an American citizen. Matthew, he loves any American event. He'll go to any American event. He'll go to St. Patrick's Day parade in the pouring rain.
What, he's just fascinated by it?
He just loves America, everything about it. Great. He's like, America does this thing so well.
That's great. That's great.
We're coming to the end of the administration. He wants to go to every event that we have. But I invited my dad and I said, you know, let's see if he says yes. Great. If he says no, he said yes. But we're in the middle of the financial crisis in 08. The election's underway. And I didn't tell the president that I invited my dad, but I thought I would when it came time. So one day I'm on Marine One waiting for him to board. And he comes out of the residence and he's waving to all the people on the lawn. And he's not making eye contact with me. He's looking out the window and he said, so I see you invited your dad to the White House.
Hmm.
I said, yes, sir. I did. He's like waving. He's like, that's a big deal. Like, yes, sir, it is. And then just as we passed the Washington Monument, he looked me straight in the eye and he said, and I am so proud of you.
Wow.
And I started crying at the Bush event. I'm like, oh, God. What that meant to me was that he not only respected my work, but he loved me.
That's amazing.
You know, and he was like that with all of us. Maybe not all of us, but, you know, their family and a leader like that, well, what they can do with the generosity of just a few words of kindness or appreciation really makes a big difference. And one of the things I say in the book is always call people on their worst day. He'd call Bill Clinton on the days that nobody would recall him. Do you remember, Matthew, in that election of 08, there was a point when Obama and Hillary Clinton are battling it out in South Carolina for the primary. And there's an ad that runs that suggests that Bill Clinton is a racist.
Yes. Yeah.
It's the worst thing that you could be called.
Yeah. Yeah.
And President Bush said, I called him on that day.
Wow.
Because those are the days when your friends need you. So that's a lesson I took with me. And I pass it on in the book that if someone's having a bad day, you should jump in because it's not going to rub off on you.
Anybody who knows me, and especially those who live with me, know how much I love a good steak for dinner. But restaurant quality steaks can't be bought at the store. That's why you need MoinkBox.com. It's a game changer. Moink delivers grass-fed and grass-finished beef and lamb, pastured pork and chicken, and wild-caught Alaskan salmon direct to your door. Helping family farms become financially independent outside of big agriculture, and then helping families like mine make sure that the meat we're eating is free of antibiotics, hormones, sugar, and all the other junk that we find prepackaged in the meat aisle at the grocery store. Moink was founded by an 8th-generation farmer who was featured on Shark Tank. Host Kevin O'Leary said it's the best bacon he's ever tasted, and I happen to agree. Matter of fact, I have some in the refrigerator right now that we're cooking up for breakfast over the weekend. And Jamie Simonoff, creator of the Ring Video Doorbell, is actually one of the investors of Moink. It's a legit company delivering some awesome meat to your house. Now, I just cooked the French cut bone-in ribeye, and it was one of the most delicious steaks that I've ever had. It never even made it to the plate. It stayed on the cutting board and we devoured it in seconds. You need to get some of this. Join the Moink movement today. Go to moinkbox.com/west right now. And listeners to this show get free ground beef for a year. That's 1 year of the best ground beef you'll ever taste, but for a limited time. Spelled M-O-I-N-K, box.com/west. That's moinkbox.com/west. You guys, with all the stuff that I'm juggling these days, I have learned the importance of finding the right people and putting them in the right place to help me, whether it's with the podcast or the music I'm making or the management company I've started. And I have spent so much time searching for the right people. Well, let me tell you something. If you're using anything other than Indeed for your hiring, you're wasting your time. Indeed.com is the hiring site. They help you find quality candidates instantly with Indeed Instant Match. So you can do the part you really need faster. Meeting and hiring great people. Now, unlike some other hiring sites, Indeed gives you full control and payment flexibility, delivering a quality shortlist faster. There are no long-term contracts. You can pause your account at any time, and you only pay for what you need. Now, this is what Indeed does. They search through millions of resumes so you don't have to. They've got them in their database, and they'll help show you great candidates instantly with Instant Match. You see a great list of candidates with zero wait. Now, Indeed delivers four times more hires than all other job sites combined. That's pretty awesome. Want your quality shortlist fast? You need Indeed. Right now, our listeners get a free $75 credit to upgrade your job post at Indeed.com/West. Indeed.com/West. The offer is valid through March 31st. This is Indeed's best offer available anywhere. Get a free $75 credit at Indeed.com/West. Offer valid through March 31st. Terms and conditions apply. I can't wait to go back and listen to this interview again myself, because like, you're dropping major wisdom, and the fact that this is just like scratching the surface of what's in the book based on your story and your experiences is just unbelievable. There's no way somebody can't grow from what you've written and what you're showing here. You talk about the word serenity in the book, and I find that to be interesting given the times that we're in. And I'm wondering if you chose to talk about the word serenity because there seems to be a lack thereof in our society right now. There's the opposite of serenity, right? I mean, serenity, peace, you're seeing an absence of that. Is that why you felt the need to touch on that in the book?
Yeah, I have an entire chapter on it. And actually, it's the reason I wrote the book. Like all the other stuff, like how to impress your boss, how to get the job or the raise, how to become a manager, a leader, all of that stuff leads up to the payoff of the book, which to me is the serenity piece. One of the reasons I wanted to write about this is that I need it in my own life. When I was growing up, we had the serenity prayer quite prominent in our home. Lord, help me to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference.
Yeah, that's great.
And my mom had been through the program Adult Children of Alcoholics, right? So my mom had grown up in an alcoholic household. She wasn't a drinker herself, but there's all sorts of things that Alcoholics Anonymous can do to help people deal with that kind of trauma. So the serenity prayer is the basis of Alcoholics Anonymous. So anyway, I have that in my life. And then when I was mentoring young women, sometimes they come into my office or on the phone and I realize they're not even breathing. They're just talking. And I think of serenity as those little glimpses of a gift from God where you feel like everything is exactly the way it's supposed to be right now. That's such a gift to have it just for like one moment. It's fleeting. It goes away, but you're like, oh, I had that. And I think that there are ways that you can find more of that in your life. So I write the chapter because I think that you won't have professional success or personal relationship success if you can't find a way to be more serene in your life. In college, I was dealing with lots of anxiety, as people do, but I would say young women in particular. I can't remember how I either came up with this or I heard about it somewhere, read about it in a book, but I call it the serenity checklist. So my advice is you take one piece of paper in three columns. The first column is your worries and concerns that are on your mind or on your heart. The second column, you check whether it's something you have control over or not. And then the third column is if you have control over any of those things, a little bit of an action plan, because it's not going to get better if you don't do something about it.
That's good.
And then I take that piece of paper and carry it with me in my back pocket, in my purse, my backpack, wherever it might be, so that if I was feeling that way, like one time I write about it in the book, I was in a cereal aisle. And my husband and I had just moved from the UK to San Diego. He was starting a business. I didn't quite have a job yet. we didn't have any money. And I was at the grocery store. I remember having this panic, but I had my piece of paper. And I remember that it was in my wallet. And I just grabbed it and I read it real quick, looked at it. I'm like, okay. You know, and I would tell myself everything's going to be okay.
I mean, that seems like too practical for us to do. Like, I mean, that's so practical. Why don't we do that more? I mean, just there's something about speaking it into existence, writing it down, putting it down in front of us. You know, one of our family counselors has worked with our daughter a little bit to, you know, in those moments of anxiousness, it's very similar to what you're talking about of like pointing to things like, what do I see right now? What do I feel? I can touch this. Like just kind of getting in the moment where you are, seeing what's real, seeing what's in front of you and seeing it for what it is. And, you know, the Bible talks about a peace that passes understanding too. And in times like these in our world, you know, I've dissected that phrase a lot and thought, wait, a peace that passes understanding. That means like it's a peace in a moment where I should be feeling anything but. And I feel like through this past year and a half, we've had every reason to feel anything but serenity, anything but peace. And I love that tactical and practical plan of just writing it down, taking a deep breath. Everything will be okay. Looking at what's in your control, what's out of your control. And isn't it amazing to be reminded? There's almost peace in remembering how much of it truly is out of our control. You know what I mean? Because I'm a control freak and I don't want to believe that it's out of my control, but there is something about that release of control and going, help me accept the things I cannot change.
My husband's very, very good at that.
How so?
Well, let's say that I have a big decision or I have a problem. I need to do something about it. I'm not sure what it is. I remember he would say to me, first of all, he's a great listener, but then he would say, you know, deciding not to do something about it right now is also a decision.
Man, yeah, that's the truth.
Oh, really?
Yeah, that's the truth. One more thing on serenity that I'm thinking about is, you know, I was so excited to speak to you today because, you know, for many reasons, obviously all of your accomplishments, you know, you get another star in your book on that's straight from me to you.
Thank you.
But, you know, the way you carry yourself day in and day out, and really specifically, I my mind goes to the amount of hours that you helped walk our family and many families around the country through the contentious election and through this pandemic. And you do so with a calm and a confidence and your own serenity in a way that if there's a storm brewing inside you or around you, somehow you're able to like calm people and my family included. And I'm going to guess that your faith is important to you and you've alluded to that different times. And I love how you describe these little moments along the way. One of the questions that I ask every guest before we part ways is I talk about a blue couch moment. And for me, it was a moment where my faith became real to me. And I really began to understand that there is a peace that I can find even when the world seems like it's spinning out of control. And my faith in God is the driving force of my life. And I was a 13-year-old kid and I stumbled across a Billy Graham crusade on television while I was sitting on the blue couch in my childhood home in the Chicago suburbs. And I just look back and there's been many moments along the way where my faith has been an anchor for me, but I just always remember that moment and the beauty of that moment. I sat with my mom and said a prayer, and I like that. I just like returning to that. And there's some moments when I feel like, is my faith real or where am I in my life? There's these anchoring moments, and that's one of them. I'd be curious for you, with all the chaos that surrounds you day in and day out, as you're reporting the news, as you're helping America figure their way through elections and pandemics, is there a blue couch moment that comes to mind for you or comes to heart for you where your faith has been real and it's reminded you that the title of your book is indeed true? Everything will be okay.
I'm trying to think if I had one in childhood, you know, because I like to get a star on my chart at the church we went to, the Lutheran church, you would get these assignments. And if you could memorize the Bible verse and you could repeat it, you know, the next Sunday, you would get a little credit that you could then spend at the church store.
Sure. Yeah. That's right up your alley.
I have a great memory. I remember everything, which my husband says is a blessing and a curse.
Yeah.
I remember I finished the Beatitudes.
Okay.
I learned the Beatitudes and I love the Beatitudes.
Memorized it. Yeah. Okay.
Yes. All of them. So I would say that. But so there's moments along the way, but I'll give you one that I think I write about a little bit in the book too. It's President Bush and Mrs. Bush were very involved in Africa and the President's Emergency Plan for AIDS Relief. And for so many years, I would recite the statistics about how they had helped people. But it wasn't until we went there in February of 2008 that I was just completely overwhelmed. And I call it getting perspective with a capital P. The president was walking by these kids that were, it was in Tanzania, and they were doing a little skit about AIDS awareness and prevention. And he walks by and he said, "God is good." And they said, "All the time."
All the time.
He says, "God is good." They said, "All the time, Mr. President."
Oh, wow.
I was like, wow. Like, right. So we've traveled all these miles and here we are. Well, fast forward. And my husband and I, after we left the White House, I felt like I needed to reset my heart. I felt like my face even was like showing a lot of anger and frustration, all the stress from the years. So we went and we volunteered at a PEPFAR site in South Africa. I was assigned to the women's hospice and he was at the men's hospice. Now, I mistakenly believed that most of the women there would speak English because we were going to South Africa, but they mostly spoke their local language, which was Xhosa. Literally no one I know can speak that or learn to speak that. So I'm in the hospice room. Nobody's communicating. I'm like, what am I doing in here? And they said, well, you could, you know, read the Bible to them. I'm like, in English? I don't know what I'm doing. Didn't feel very logical to me. And I was thinking very logically. And then this one patient, she asked for a nail polish remover and the nail polish from the nurse. And when the nurse came out, they had like this tiny little bottle of nail polish that was left. And she had to put alcohol in the remover or in it to thin it out enough.
Sure. Yeah.
And I had this idea. So I went over to the men's ward and asked Peter if he could take me to the store. So we drive to the store and I got 8 manicure kits.
Oh.
And a whole bunch of nail polish. And I went back and I set up like a nail salon.
Oh, man.
And I asked all the ladies, I was like, anybody here want your nails done? Well, guess what, Matthew? They all spoke English.
They did.
They just didn't know, what is this blonde girl doing here? Just sitting in here in the hospice.
Oh, man.
And they were surprised that I was willing to touch them.
Oh.
To do their nails.
Sure.
But it was a real reminder that, you know, women all over the world can communicate in ways that are really important. And so I feel this obligation to give back here and there, but also that does something for me. So I have to find ways to live my faith. I also started, my last thing is, 2 years ago, I was feeling quite privileged and just way too into myself. And of course, you're here in New York.
I don't know anything about that.
Like, I mean, you got 2 shows and you left this great place and you have a weekend house. Everything's like, and my health is good. Everything's great. And I was like, everyone's going through something. And I was going through some things here, you know, like the attacks and the criticism, it can get to be a lot. I try to ignore it for the most part, but it's a lot. So I started doing this thing where anybody that I saw, including like on the subway, I would just send them a little prayer or a little wish silently. So it might be, I hope she passes that test she's studying for. I hope they get home safely today. I hope nobody's mean to him today. I hope they get that raise that they're looking for. I just like, just try to like get out of myself. That has helped a little bit. Wow, this is really like therapy.
No, I mean, what you're sharing is therapy for somebody else. And I love the phrase you said. I don't even know if you realize you said it, but feeling the need to reset your heart.
Yeah.
To have that level of self-awareness to go and say, you know what? I got to go to a third world country if that's what it takes, or walking down the road. And I talk a lot about the importance of becoming a character in somebody else's story. And I wonder if, you know, serenity, the elusive serenity and peace that we're looking for, you know, is even harder to find when we're looking within and focusing on being the main character in our own story. And so it's amazing to think that, hey, you're having these blue couch moments, these anchoring moments that are helping to reset your heart by looking beyond your own needs and seeing the needs of other people. I am so excited for everybody to read this book. And I don't know if they told you, but just doing this podcast is probably going to sell you a million books. It's going to just like, this is going to be huge. No,
I hope so. You know, it's sold out. So I did read the audiobook and there's the Kindle, but they're printing more. They're on their way.
I love audiobooks. I've been taking these like Forrest Gump kind of walks during the pandemic and I pop in an audiobook.
Me too. I listened to The Splendid and the Vile by Eric Larson, which is the book about Winston Churchill. It's this big, it's thick. But I listened to it during the pandemic. I would go for an hour-long walk after the show every day and just, if there's a good narrator.
Yeah.
The audiobooks are terrific.
And you narrate your own?
I did this time, yes.
So none of the listeners to this podcast are going to be worrying about that Winston Churchill book. They're going to be too busy getting Everything Will Be Okay by Dana Perino. Dana, thanks for choosing to not keep your wisdom within, but to be a mentor for everybody who picks up this book. Thanks for being somebody that I would be proud to have my daughters look up to, and for telling all the young women out there that they can, that it is possible. You're paying forward what your dad did for you with that yellow shirt. That, and I feel like your book is its own yellow shirt for a lot of people who need to know that the ceiling is high for them. I'm so glad that you would join me today. I'm honored. And when you come to Nashville, I'd love to take you to lunch sometime. Well, I'll show you some of my favorite restaurants.
I would love to shake your hand, and I would love to meet your daughters.
Oh, they would love to meet you as well. But this has been an honor. Thank you so much for sharing your stories and sharing your time with me today.
Thank you.
Now it's time for Songs from the Story House. Today's song from the Story House is called Broken Things.
If grace was a kingdom, I stopped at the gate, thinking I don't deserve to pass through after all the mistakes that I've made. Oh, but I heard a whisper as heaven bent down. Said, child, don't you know that the first will be last and the last get a crown?
I love this song so much. I loved it ever since we wrote it. We wrote it in the cabin. It was Alan Jackson's old cabin in Tennessee, and we were camped out. My buddy AJ Prues, who you hear me talk about a lot, and another friend of mine, Jason Hauser, who actually helped discover me. He kind of gave me my first opportunity, and he co-produced my independent record, which was called Sellout, and he really kind of helped open some doors for me to get my official record deal. And so we've written a lot of songs over the years, songs like More, songs like The Motions, and now this song, Broken Things. He came to stay with us at the cabin for a couple days, and this was one of the songs that came out of it. Now, my buddy AJ had this hook that takes place in the song, the signature hook, and anybody who knows my music knows that I'm a sucker for a good whoa part or oh part or some sort of vocal hook. And hook means, for those who aren't in music, a hook just means something memorable, something signature, something catchy, something that when the song's over, you might find yourself singing again. And this one, it just felt like a real heart cry, and I loved it so much. And so take a listen to this second verse, and it's kind of something, a familiar refrain that you might hear me discuss in my music, of just this reminder of scripture and how throughout history, God has had a history of not picking the pristine and the perfect, because there's no such thing, but doing great things through broken things. Check this out.
The pages of history, they tell me it's true. It's never the perfect, it's always the ones with the scars that you use. Oh, it's the rebels and the prodigals, it's the humble and the weak. All the misfit heroes you chose, tell me there's hope for sinners like me. And now I'm just a
I've taken some inventory of the songs that I've written over the years, and I feel like there's one word that I sing more than any other word. One word that finds its way into my lyrics more than any other word, and that word is grace. And here's why. Simply put, I write songs about what I know I need, what I know I don't deserve, and what gives me hope to wake up every single morning and know that with the rising of the sun, God has promised me new mercies. In other words, He knows I'm a broken thing, but He promises me that He's my healer and I don't have to stay a broken thing. I always quote my friend Max Licato, who says, God loves you just the way that you are, but He refuses to let you stay that way. He wants to make you just like Jesus. All the broken things who are thankful that God's not done with you yet, can I get an amen? Listen to this final verse. You'll see what I'm talking about and be reminded that there's a seat at the table that's waiting for you. So come on inside. For sinners like me. And now I'm just a beggar in the presence of a king. I wish I could bring so much more. But if it's true, you use broken things, then here I am, Lord, I'm all yours.
There's a seat at the table just waiting for you, so come on inside.
He's my dad and he gives good advice, and that's why this last segment of every episode is called Dadvice.
He is my dad and he gives good advice, and that's why this segment is called Dadvice.
Dad, thanks for joining me as always. We've been focused since the beginning of this year on two words, brand new. And we're just coming out of the Easter holiday and we celebrate how the cross offers us brand new love. So can you share some more about the gift that was given to us with Jesus giving his life on a cross?
Yes, we're going to talk about this, the greatest love ever given. I mentioned my mom a lot in times I share, and I'm so thankful for a mom that since I was a little kid would tell me all about Jesus' love, and she would teach me a song called Jesus Loves Me, This I Know, For the Bible Tells Me So. Today's verse is about this great love, John 15:13. Greater love has no one than this, than to lay down one's life for his friends. Jesus spoke these words just hours before he was to be crucified. Now, Jesus wasn't telling them what this greater love looked like. He was about to show them what it looked like for a man to lay down his life for another. I want us to quickly just look at two words here, key words, taken and given. Jesus was crucified at Golgotha, meaning a place of the skull, a place where guilty criminal lives were taken. However, this day would be different. On this day, lives would be both taken and given. The word taken means to remove one's hands, to eliminate. The thieves that hung on either side of Jesus were guilty men, and their lives were taken. But then look at the word given. Given means to freely transfer, to cause, to hand over. Jesus was innocent, and yet his life was given. What a difference between the words given and taken. Those who were crucifying Jesus thought they were taking the life of a guilty man. In reality, they were witnessing an innocent man giving his life for us. The death of Jesus is not the story of a life being taken. It's the story of a life being given for you and me. The greatest verse in the Bible, John 3:16. We can't say it enough, not just at Easter, for God so loved the world that he gave his one and only son, that whoever believes in him should not perish, but have eternal life. Jesus gave his life for all people. This was a brand new love. It was all inclusive. Even as Jesus was breathing his final breaths on Calvary's cross, he gave eternal life to the guilty thief hanging next to him, saying, "Today you will be with me in paradise." I have this great story about my seven-year-old granddaughter, Althea. She loves to set and decorate the table when we have dinner at her house. She calls it Fancy Pants Diner. One night she made place cards, and the place cards read, one had common seat on it, and my name was on it, as well as her dad and her brother Sully. One had bad seat on it, and that was her older brother Boston. And the other had royal seat at the table, and it had Nanny and Althea's name. And I thought just how different God is for us is that we're all invited to the table, and we all have royal on it and not bad seat or common seat. Sometimes we feel that we're too bad to forever to sit at God's table, but that's not true. We're all royal. This Easter, we are not mourning a sad story of a life taken. We are celebrating the greatest love of a life given. He takes away the sins of the world by giving his very own life. There is no greater love than this. Billy Graham said, "God proved his love on the cross when Christ hung and bled and died. It was God saying to the world, I love you." Celebrate his love today.
Grace is a kingdom with gates open wide, and there's a seat at the table just waiting for you. So come on inside. Thanks for that reminder of a brand new love, Dad. Hey, that's our show for today. I want to thank my guest, Dana Perino, for joining me, for taking some time out of her crazy busy schedule to share some stories and talk about her new book. We're going to post a link to the new book at MatthewWest.com/podcast. I highly recommend it. Be sure to check it out. I mean, when you can get wisdom from someone like Dana, I don't know why you wouldn't take advantage of that. That's for sure. Hey, speaking of wisdom, I also want to thank my dad, Reverend Joseph West, for joining me every week with Dadvice. The comments that I get from you folks about how that segment every week is encouraging you and pointing you towards Jesus is just amazing. So thank you, Dad. Hey, listen, our ministry, my dad and I have a ministry called Pop We, P-O-P-W-E. Say it with me, Pop We. And we are in place to help you learn how to tell a more fulfilling story with the one life that you get. You hear me say it at the end of every episode. It's your story for his glory. If you'd like to find out more about our ministry, go to popwe.org. And one of the things you can do there is sign up to receive a free weekly devotional from us. They're called Day One Devos. It's just a quick little reminder, free of charge, to spend some time with Jesus, because you can't make it through your story without him. So go to popwe.org to find out more information about how you can get plugged in with our ministry. We want to help do life with you and help you learn how to live a more fulfilling story with the one life you get. With that, I want to encourage you to remember that it's your story for his glory. Have a great week. I'll see you next time on the Matthew West Podcast.
Seriously, I do.